This is Smart Women, Smart Power, a podcast that features conversations with some of the world's most powerful women. We feature thought leaders at all career levels, where we explore, among other things, the many contributions that women make to the fields of international business, national security, foreign policy, and international development. Does having women in positions of power influence the outcomes of decisions in these fields? Why or why not? Join me, Dr. Kathleen McInnes, Director of the Smart Women, Smart Power Initiative at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, for these incredible conversations. This year marks the second anniversary of Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine, the 75th anniversary of NATO, and a U.S. presidential election, all in the backdrop of rising tension in the Indo-Pacific and the Middle East. Today on Smart Women, Smart Power, the newly appointed ambassador of the European Union to the United States, Jovita Nilushina, is here to help us understand why the U.S.-European Union relationship remains critical. This is Smart Women, Smart Power, a podcast that features conversations with some of the world's most powerful women. Welcome to Smart Women, Smart Power. We've lots to dive into. You've got a very busy schedule and lots going on the US-EU agenda. But here in Smart Women, Smart Power, we really like to start with people's origin stories. Like, what got you into the field? What inspired you to join this world of foreign policy?
Well, I have to admit that when I was finishing my studies, I said to myself, no, I would not go to foreign policy. never. So I ended up in the national security field. But maybe it's too narrow. Maybe I still end up in the foreign policy. Then I worked for the bilateral issues, and I said I would never go to the multilateral stuff. And I ended up as the EU advisor for the president. So you know, the personal lesson I learned: never say never to anything.
Movies and career choices. Never say never.
Exactly. I think that it was when I was graduating my school. It was really the change, probably of history, because it was just some years after Lithuania regained independence, and the school of political science and foreign relations was just established and just very brand new. And I thought that, you know, I think that I have some qualities I would like to contribute, and maybe not. I was not really so determined that I will do foreign policy as such, but I was thinking that, you know, working for the state, working for the country, would be really the path I want to go.
Mm-hmm. Well, so to turn to the war in Ukraine, as you mentioned earlier, we're just hitting the second anniversary of the full-scale invasion, the 10th anniversary of, you know, since Crimea in 2014. And unfortunately, right now, there is no end in sight. I'd be interested in your perspective, you know, sitting in the European Union and this direct conduit between the U.S. and the European Union, and Ukraine is on top of the agenda. What is the current landscape from the EU perspective?
I think that this two-year mark actually comes in their quite gloomy perspective. Although, you know, Ukraine achieved over those 2 years, the Ukrainian achievements are tremendous. You know, Russia and Putin thought that it will take a couple of days or a couple of weeks to run through a neighboring country. But Ukraine managed to regain almost 50% of the territories that Russia first occupied. Even being in the war, they managed actually to push out Russian Black Sea Fleet from Crimea Peninsula.
Which is astonishing.
And actually, this had a huge influence in the food security situation globally, because, you know, Ukraine is the global actor in providing grain and food security for all the world, and the prices were immediately stabilized after that. And you know, and more on top of that, Ukrainians, even you know, from the trenches, as I said, they are doing a reform, extremely difficult and complicated reforms. Because they said they want to be part of the EU.
Right.
And they were looking for their invitation to start negotiations of the accession to the to the EU. And, you know, the European Union is never easy.
Well, yeah, it takes a little while.
It takes a little while. And, you know, you get the recommendations, what you have to do. And, you know, it's difficult for countries to do those, you know, to change the laws on transparency, on anti-money laundering, anti-corruption, to reform your judiciary system, even if you are at peace. And for the country at war, it's even more complicated. So I think that, you know, we have to give really a huge credit for Ukraine, Ukrainian people, and their belief that their future is in Europe, in the transatlantic community, and they are actually delivering and doing. So it's really now our time to deliver on what they need. So you know, I'm generally very happy what happened in Europe, because the understanding that Ukraine is actually fighting for our values, you know, freedom, democracy, rule of law, human rights. Now, these are values we are based on, or EU is based based on. So the, that, you know, the support is really massive, decisive, and that, you know, over the 2 years, you know, 96 billion euros, billion dollars, sorry, and plus $54 billion just recently, earlier this month, makes like $160 billion, which is quite a huge part what Ukraine needs. But still,
well, it takes it takes a lot of resources to dislodge one of the world's most powerful militaries from defensive positions, right? Like, it's just, this is this was never going to be a cheap war, right? Like, there was never any way to do this.
It's even
without significant resources.
It's even more, you know. We all consider the, or will, you know, coming from the foreign policy background, and as well, I'm sure in the think tanks, we all kind of looked at Russia 2 years ago and thought that we have to deal with the second largest army, or second most powerful army in the world, and look where we are now.
That's true.
So definitely, it's not neither a easy war, neither a cheap war. It requires a lot of resources. It requires life. It's a question of life and death, and it's a question of the existential threat for Ukraine. Because I think what is extremely important, we actually have to take what dictators are saying seriously, because they usually mean. Because our major fault before that was that we kind of were thinking that, well, this is just some kind of a rhetoric expressions.
Right, because it just didn't, the logic of the war didn't make any sense, right? And from our perspective. But yeah, you're exactly right. They tend to, you know, believe the mission statement when they articulate it. I'd love you, if we could, digress for a moment about, you know, EU accession and what that will mean for, you know, tackling Ukrainian corruption. That corruption in Ukraine, concerns about graft, have been front of mind to many policymakers here in Washington, I would argue. But EU accession is one of the tools that is being utilized to start getting at that, not to mention the Ukrainians' own will to tackle corruption. So I'd love it if you could share a couple of thoughts on that.
So, you know, now we have, in general, accession process is quite complicated, and all the way through you have to have all the member states on board. So it's difficult to kind of squeeze without making your homework, if I may put like that.
Then, I mean, we're talking like tens of thousands of pages in the
It could be quite even though tens of thousands, and it could be in more than that. Because it's a really very complicated and technical process. But the thing is that right now the process is organized in the way that, first of all, you have to start and to finalize your negotiations on what we call the fundamentals. That means you have to reform your judiciary. You have to reform your anti-corruption institutions. You have to pass the laws, which actually goes through scrutiny, that they are in line with the rule of law regulation of the EU. And then you actually, of course, what is concerning human rights and the fundamental rights, which are in UN Charter and in European documents. So to do that, you actually have really almost all your judges and the law enforcement institution people should probably go through their certain scrutiny. Institutional changes under the laws should be passed. Some of them have been done even before starting negotiations, because that was a recommendation of the Commission and requirement from the other member states. But always is the question of implementation. So that when the negotiation starts, it will be the question of the implementation. So no, there's a very I think that one of the easiest or the easier to understand the process. Like, for example, EU has a requirement that the funds or the sources of your funds, whatever you as the private citizen or this, or for example, as their member of the parliament, you have to declare online. And EU goes after how you declare, how the law prescribes that. Is this actually law done according to the EU regulation? So really, you at a certain point in the negotiations, you actually have an access to all the money, all the profits, what politicians or civil servants or the law enforcement people have. This is, how it works. It works in Lithuania. If you want, you can Google me and to see how much I earn per year. So the same has to happen, and this will go, what is extremely important as well, to for example, the people who are running state-owned enterprises, because this is important part and
Yes, absolutely.
of the economy. And of course, there should be as well probably their privatization and continued process of privatization and so on and so forth. So it's really, it goes law by law, chapter by chapter. It's very lengthy, and it could be a quite painful process, because not only due to their some kind of the groups of influence, but in general, because it costs, to have their electronic declaration system where everybody can log in, put, and it will not crack down. You have to have really,
Sophisticated systems. These are expensive.
Yes,
Yeah,
and you
absolutely.
have to have, anti-money laundering system, to follow up all your banks.
Yeah.
You still have to have institutions in place, infrastructure in place. But, I think that there are two major things. There is a will of Ukrainian people and Ukrainian institution. This is one thing. Another thing, there is a will in the EU,
Yeah.
within the EU institutions and the member states. And there is a huge support, which comes technical and of course financial support, in order to help to build those institutions.
Yeah.
It took even for smaller countries, it took
It
a
takes,
while.
yeah,
It takes it
decades.
takes in general, it takes time, to change the law or to pass the law through the parliament, and then you have to implement it.
If I could ask, what is the EU's vision for victory in Ukraine? What's the long-term success plan
I think
or idea?
the long-term success plan is definitely within the EU. What Ukraine needs, and what I think we all need. And I think that we have to focus on that, because if one of the biggest probably so Putin already lost their second strongest army reputation. in general, he lost Ukrainian people for probably 2-3 generations as
Easily, yeah.
the Slavic nations,
Turns out,
Franco-Prussian.
going to war and trying to like commit genocide against a
Yes,
people will, you know, have a reaction.
he had enlarged NATO
Yes,
already,
yep.
and today's Hungarian parliament decision moves as well Sweden closer to NATO membership as well. So, you know, so the last probably bit that Ukrainian success, be it economic, be it political, you know, take any sector, is a huge loss because his own people will look at that and question where the place where they are right now.
So shifting gears a bit, I'd love to turn to the decision that you brought with you today, which I think is absolutely fascinating and courageous from Lithuania's perspective, which was to when Lithuania decided to pursue closer economic relations with Taiwan, including establishing a relationship with Taiwan in Lithuania. So, and there were all sorts of negative repercussions, and this is a big, I mean, but also positive benefits too. So I'd love to ask you to set the scene for us. What was happening at the time? Where were you? And why did this decision come up on the agenda for Lithuania the way it did?
Well, you know, every country wish to have a success and successful economy because the economic growth is, you know, that helps to make sure that you have a support of people, you can ensure prosperity for your people. And many EU countries actually have trade relations with Taiwan. In Lithuania, there was a request of coming from Taiwan to establish trade representation in Vilnius. And probably the biggest problem was that the name of this representation. And then you end up in.
How so? What do you mean by the problem was the name?
So their idea was that the Taiwanese trade representation in Vilnius would be established, and it was established. And even there, we are part of the Lithuania is part of the EU. We're members of EU, so One China policy is the policy we follow. And I think that it's not a secret that we are among the most pro-European countries and really quite good pupils, pupils in class, saying that, trying to follow the rules and procedures, whatever EU produce. So we were surprised to find out that one day that China just switched off the trade with
With Lithuania.
Lithuania.
So just one day, bam. They
Yes,
just
so
like
there was a they call it a glitch, but in general it was economic coercion that you could not export goods to China anymore. And of course it grew a lot of stories and mysteries about that. But I think that what is extremely important that EU is the is organization which has a single market. So if you go against one member state, actually it has an influence on the whole single market. And I think that it was really very much appreciated in Lithuania that you know EU and EU institutions and the EU member states actually stood together and saying like it's not acceptable what is happening.
So because my understanding of the situation was so that the trade representation gets established. Lithuania withdraws from the 17 plus one, like grouping, which allows European countries to have greater access to or you know cooperation with Beijing. So that happens, and then Beijing slaps you know again this glitch in trade. There's primary and secondary sanctions, but I also my understanding is that Beijing started to try to apply pressure in Germany and other countries to try to then put pressure on Vilnius. Is that...
Well, you know, the pressure is always there. Economic
is it?
Okay. Economic coercion comes quite often. And
okay.
When you're living next to the big country, other big country, you
okay.
you get, if not used to that, but mm-hmm. You kind of are really very much aware of this happening. So, you know, in general, this switching off and not possibility no export mm-hmm. anything to China meant that, well, we end up from the 360 million euros of trade per year to almost zero.
Wow.
One day.
Wow.
Just one day. You wake up and that's there was a there was no possibility to export because Lithuania was not in the customs system anymore.
Okay. That's wow.
So, you know, I was responsible. I was in the Ministry of Economy and Innovation at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And responsible in general promoting export and investment. So on one hand, I was responsible to attract investments from Taiwan.
Right.
On the other, kind of promote exports wherever it's our business can go.
Sure, sure.
Because that's the job description. So we ended up, of course, working on several projects with Taiwanese, but not mm-hmm. only with Taiwanese, as well with the other Indo-Pacific countries. Mm-hmm. Within less than a year, we managed to get into the three and a half, let's say, contract relations mm-hmm. on investments. Taiwanese actually went as well quite bold,
yeah,
because they really decided on 1 billion investments all around Central and Eastern Europe,
mm-hmm.
As well 200 million loans. So it was yeah. really quite bold for their Central Eastern European countries. But another, what is important thing is as well, we established relations with Taiwanese in cooperation for chips and
right.
Semiconductors.
Yep. Yeah.
And I think that's extremely important for their small mm-hmm. Small and medium countries
mm-hmm.
you know, to be part of the supply chain of highly advanced technologies.
To what extent was the question about values and countering authoritarianism a part of that conversation? Or was it just sort of...
But I think that, you know, the situation was kind of an amplification.
Interesting.
Of those values. As the small country, or I shouldn't call maybe a small country of Lithuania, but as the sovereign country,
mm-hmm.
you have a decision to establish more or more progressive or more in-depth economic and trade relations with, well, all authorities around the world.
Yeah.
Where you think
makes sense.
Makes sense or your interests lies.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the essence of sovereignty, that
yeah.
you are a sovereign country and you are making a decision. And here comes someone, or in this particular example, China, and said, like, no, you cannot make a better trade or better relations, or you cannot trade more with Taiwan.
Right.
Just because.
Right.
So there is kind of a... example that, you know, if you are big,
mm-hmm.
so might makes right.
Yeah.
I'm not sure. So I think that this is there how you have to be very, very not careful, but very mindful.
Sure.
About your allies and about your trade relations to make sure that your over-reliance on
yeah.
one or another country
is not
could be very costly.
Yes,
as we have seen actually 2 years or ago.
Well, you just mentioned that, you know, the might equals right or might makes right. That brings me to this question: what, in your view, does power mean? What is power? How, in thinking about your career over time, how have you seen power effectively exercised? I mean, like, just like for a PhD type of topic, why not dive in?
You know, it's a topic for PhD. I spent quite a lot of time when I was writing my PhD on more on soft power and how the soft power is exercised, actually. And, you know, I think that when Nye started to write about soft power 20 years already or 25 years 25 years ago, he actually haven't thought that we will end up that soft power is quite hard, especially in the time of information or in the time of post-information, if you
and
wish.
With economic coercion as well.
And with the economic coercion that actually economy, energy, information can be weaponized.
Right.
And I think that this actually, that's why we are kind of back to your previous question is when you see, you know, it's a value-based question or it's a democracies versus autocracies question, where you do believe that if you share, if you have a lot of interdependence, that makes your model more attractive.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, the other side, the autocrat, is actually abusing your system.
Yeah.
Your democratic values, they're creating this, for example, if we take energy, we bought quite a lot from Russia within the EU even. Mm-hmm. And at the end of the day, it doesn't really help, you know, for making changes within the Russian society or Russian elite. We take information, you know, and we see that, you know, when we speak about freedom of speech, others are using that to spread disinformation and, you know, foreign policy influence is an act in our own societies. And then we take trade. We thought actually in this very neoliberal paradigm that if we actually trade more, if we have really a global market, then we actually are kind of getting closer in our values. Our societies have more and more people-to-people contact, and this would build trust and understanding that which model is more sustainable, if you wish, more pro-human rights, more pro-rights in general. But nothing of that happened because, you know, the instrument was there, and whenever it's of interest, it can be used not only against countries, against companies, but when it was used against companies, we thought that okay, maybe it's just an accident, maybe they just criticized, and you know, you ended up that you have companies in the Western Hemisphere which actually have a Communist Party units in their companies themselves. I'm not sure if we would be allowed to do that, you know, to promote our values in the companies which are working in China, for example.
Right.
So, no. But one thing, what is extremely, how to say, surprised me in positive about the EU itself, even I'm dealing with EU for quite a long time already, is that, you know, when, you know, there was a huge pressure on Lithuania, it was really taken as an example of what can happen to, as I said, not only to Lithuania as a country or Lithuanian economy, let's put like that, but to their single market.
Right.
Now, what kind of influence? Because, you know, Lithuania produce a lot of components for German automotive, which are exported to China, India, and all around the world. And, well, it seems that some of the cars cannot function by very small part, which is produced in Lithuania. So it took less than half a year for the Council of European countries to make a decision to produce an anti-coercion instrument.
Which is amazing. Like the fact that it happened within 6 months and the fact that it happened, like that's a big, so is it fair to say that the Chinese move kind of backfired?
Of course, but this is always with the dictators. You know, if you actually push too hard, I think that it at the end, especially within the EU, you get mobilized those positive forces and more understanding that if it happens with Lithuania, next time it could be some other ones, and we have to have right instruments and right toolbox to be prepared.
So to wrap up our conversation, and reflecting on all of this, do you think your gender as a woman has, you know, had an impact on these decisions that you've taken or supported? And if so, why? But if not, why not?
You know, I think in foreign policy, the most important is principle. If you can stand for your own, you know, your opinion for country or for organization, if you feel strong on your values, on what you believe, and if it's worth fighting, I think it's extremely important and does not really very much, maybe depends on gender. I do believe in teams and coalitions and coalition building. Here, maybe gender comes in. That, you know, it's maybe sometimes it's I wouldn't say easier, but somehow the first idea which would come. So if I like you know, if I really want to push for a Ukraine membership in EU, if I really think that, for example, for their getting state aid for the companies which were really badly damaged because of the Chinese trade, if I think about, you know, some kind of their I don't know, MFF negotiations, like budget negotiations on the EU level. My first idea is actually, do I have a coalition? Can I build one?
Interesting. So it's like a methodology of coalition building. Yeah.
So
okay.
So I see that as a kind of a, can I have more partners on this issue? And maybe this kind of is a bit of gender related, because you always think that, okay, maybe one voice is not enough.
Interesting.
Maybe your voice is not enough.
That's interesting.
So you kind of trying to bring people together and see how we can go around together. Maybe not in the, you know, maybe it's better sometimes 80% but done, not 100%, which is somewhere
something perfect. Well, thank you so much for joining us today, Madam Ambassador. And so for those who are tuning in on YouTube, have a look at the CSIS.org website. There's all sorts of content on, you know, what's the issues of the day, strategic matters globally. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Subscribe to the Smart Women Smart Power podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to great content. Be sure to follow us on Twitter at Smart Women, or you can follow me on Twitter at KJ McInnes1. Thanks for listening, and join us next time.